They began to imitate the way of life practiced in the early church, applying themselves to frequent prayer, watching and fasting, preaching the word of life to as many as they could, despising all worldly things as not belonging to them, receiving only their necessary food from those they taught, living themselves in all respects in accordance with what they prescribed to others, and being always disposed to suffer any adversity, and even to die for that truth which they preached. Before long, a number believed and were baptized, admiring the simplicity of their holy lives and the comfort of their heavenly message. This is a vivid description of a community of believers living and preaching Christian truth, baptizing those who believed, and seeking to follow the way of life practiced in the early church. In many ways, it reflects an ideal which, as Christadelphians, we have also tried to live up to. Yet, it's actually a description of the monks sent from Rome by Pope Gregory the Great with a mission to convert the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms of England, beginning with the Kingdom of Kent in AD 597. In opening with the example of these missionaries to the Anglo-Saxons, I'm making no judgment about their faith as individuals. Instead, I'd like to take a historical perspective and to consider how Christadelphians fit in the broad sweep of Christian history. Pope Gregory's mission is simply an example of how one aspect of Christadelphian teaching, the ideal of returning to the simplicity of beliefs and practices of the early church, is also reflected in earlier communities and movements within Christian history. This discussion of Christadelphians in historical perspective will take the form of two articles. In this first article, I'll consider the background to Christadelphian beliefs, with reflections on different understandings of what a church is, examples of movements seeking to reform or break away from the established church, and accounts of communities which shared aspects of Christadelphian beliefs, including believers' baptism and non-Trinitarian understandings of God. In the second article, I'll be discussing the more immediate historical origins of Christadelphians in late 18th and early 19th century Britain and the United States, seeing how Christadelphian founder John Thomas engaged with but ultimately separated from other Christian groups, and reflecting on what we can learn from this legacy in our personal faith and in our relationship with other Christians today. A significant transition in the history of Christianity took place in the 4th century AD. Before then, Christianity had spread organically, often in the face of persecution, although over time more formal leadership structures emerged, and leading Christian thinkers began to integrate Christian theology with approaches from Greek philosophy. However, in AD 313, under the Roman Emperor Constantine I, there was a more dramatic change when Christianity was accepted as a recognized religion of the empire. Constantine found Christians to be divided on the question of Christ's nature and relationship to God. He convened the First Council of Nicaea in AD 325 with the aim of bringing unity to the church and arguably greater cohesion to his empire. The council concluded with its Trinitarian formulation that Jesus Christ is consubstantial with the Father. The legacy of Constantine was later consolidated by the Emperor Theodosius I in the Edict of Thessalonica. This edict stated that all peoples of the empire should now practice Christianity, and that this was to be defined by belief in the single deity of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, under the concept of equal majesty and of the Holy Trinity. Anyone not accepting this specifically Trinitarian definition of Christianity was punishable by the state. The rest, however, whom we adjudge demented and insane, shall sustain the infamy of heretical dogmas, their meeting places shall not receive the name of churches, and they shall be smitten first by divine vengeance, and secondly by the retribution of our own initiative. These 4th-century developments set the framework for a view of the church as an institution of the state, with its beliefs and practices determined by government edict and enforceable by law. This model of the church has historically found expression in various forms. For example, in the Eastern Orthodox churches, in European Catholic confessional states, and in established Protestant churches like the Church of England. In most, although not all cases, state churches have also embraced a Trinitarian theology. However, alongside this model of the church as an institution of the state, there has always existed an alternative understanding of the church as a community of believers, gathering not under compulsion, but freely and voluntarily in faith. Of course, many Christians within state churches have also held strong personal convictions, but often Christians have been led by a deeper level of commitment or by theological differences to pursue alternative forms of association, either within or outside of established churches. We can already see this trend within 3rd and 4th century Christianity. For example, the Desert Fathers and Desert Mothers were early Christian ascetics who withdrew from the formal institutions of church and society, leading in turn to the growth of early monasticism. Other movements were labelled as heretical, for example, the Donatists in North Africa, who pursued a purer form of Christianity, rejecting the compromises which had been made during periods of persecution. Whatever the diversity of these movements, underlying them is an understanding of a Christian community formed by personal conviction and commitment, rather than simply external conformity to a state religion. I opened with the early English historian Bede's description of the community of monks sent by Pope Gregory on a mission to evangelise among the Anglo-Saxons. This example is interesting because although the monks based their life and preaching on the early church, they carried supporting letters from the neighbouring Frankish kings and targeted their preaching at King Ethelbert of Kent and his court. This illustrates the way in which the two visions of the church outlined above could coexist with the ideal of an apostolic community of believers often pursued by Christians within the framework of a state church. As the medieval Catholic Church increasingly became entangled with political power, this ideal became harder to sustain. Monastic communities can be seen in part as a reaction to the church's involvement with worldly secular power. Successive monastic reform movements, such as the Cluniac reforms in the 10th century and the Cistercian reforms in the 12th century, sought to return monasteries to the apostolic life of the primitive church. However, sometimes movements to return to the ideal of the early church ended up either breaking away from or being excluded from the state church. For example, in the late 12th century, Peter Valdez or Waldo, 1140 to 1205, a merchant from Lyon, France, began to advocate a return to the apostolic life through poverty and preaching, with his followers becoming known as Waldenses. Their preaching was seen as a threat to the authority of the established church, and the Waldenses were condemned as heretics in 1184. A more direct challenge to the authority of the Catholic Church came with the writings of Oxford scholar John Wycliffe, 1330 to 1384, who argued against the authority of clergy and the Pope, challenged key Catholic doctrines such as that of transubstantiation, and began to translate the Bible into English. In England, he inspired a movement of lay reformers known as Lollards, while in the Kingdom of Bohemia, his ideas were taken up by the Czech priest and reformer Jan Hus. Hus and his followers, the Hussites, fused their ambition to reform the church with an early sense of Czech national identity, leading to the Hussite Wars. Once again, despite the differences between them, the various reform and protest movements within the medieval church shared a desire to establish communities of voluntarily committed believers, rather than seeing the church as a hierarchical state institution. All were inspired in one way or another by the ideal of returning to the simplicity of the early church, although the Catholic Church's dominance and close ties with secular power left little room for such movements to develop independently. A much greater disruption in the history of the Western Christian Church took place with the advent of the Protestant Reformation in the early 16th century, beginning with the German monk Martin Luther, 1483 to 1546. The Protestant reformers challenged Catholic teachings in many areas, including with their doctrine of sola scriptura, the belief that scripture alone, rather than the Pope or church hierarchy, is the ultimate authority for church teaching and practice. However, in terms of church structure, the most prominent Protestant reformers continued to work within the established church-state framework. For example, in the Holy Roman Empire, the Lutheran, historically the Evangelical Church, was gradually adopted by individual rulers of constituent states, whose right to determine the religion of their territory was confirmed by the Peace of Augsburg, 1555. The Reformed Church, which emerged in Switzerland, latterly under the guidance of John Calvin, 1509 to 1564, was also adopted by secular governments, beginning with Zurich and several other cantons of the Swiss Confederacy. In England, the Church of England was established by Henry VIII, with himself replacing the Pope as the Church's supreme head. This continuing alliance between church and state has led some historians to refer to mainstream Protestantism as the Magisterial Reformation, as it was connected to magistrates, i.e. secular rulers. However, alongside the mainstream Protestant Reformation was a further wave of religious reform known as the Radical Reformation. Radical reformers generally saw the church not as a state institution to which all members of society belonged, but as a community of believers, united by shared convictions and freely associating together. Among the first of such groups were the Anabaptists, rebaptizers, a term used pejoratively by those who believed infant baptism to be sufficient. Anabaptists first emerged in Protestant Zurich in the 1520s. Their practice of baptizing adult believers was so controversial that, with deliberate and cruel irony, the group's leaders were put to death by drowning in the River Limmat. Groups encompassed within the term Radical Reformation were generally small and varied. For example, some radicals, like Thomas Munzer, 1490 to 1525, advocated violent social unrest, which he believed would lead to the second coming of Christ. Others, like Menno Simons, 1496 to 1561, and his followers, the Mennonites, advocated a pacifist withdrawal from the world. In general, the earliest groups do not seem to have challenged the doctrine of the Trinity, but they did tend to avoid the traditional language of the creeds in their statements of faith, such as the Schleitheim Confession of the Swiss Anabaptists, 1527, and they rejected traditional forms of church authority. This opened the way for even more radical interpretations of the Christian faith. From the 1530s, some radical religious thinkers began to question the doctrine of the Trinity. As we have seen, this doctrine was closely intertwined with the concept of a state church, as both were established in the Roman Empire in the 4th century. However, the Radical Reformation provided the context for the Spanish theologian Michael Servetus, 1511 to 1553, to challenge this core teaching in his work De Trinitatis Erroribus, on the Errors of the Trinity, 1531. This was followed by Christianismi Restitutio, the Restitution of Christianity, 1553, advocating a return to a simpler, more biblical form of Christianity, including the practice of adult baptism. Servetus was operating in the world of ideas and scholarly debate, and does not seem to have attracted a direct following. It's also important to note that his theological understanding was complex, and he developed a nuanced account of his understanding of the human and divine natures of Christ. However, Servetus's clear rejection of the doctrine and language of the Trinity led to him being pursued by both Catholic and Protestant authorities. On passing through Geneva in 1553, he was recognised by Calvin, arrested, and after a two-month trial by a Protestant court, found guilty of anti-Trinitarianism and Anabaptism. He was sentenced to be burnt, along with his heretical book, and he died at the stake. His punishment illustrates the gulf between the magisterial reformers and the more radical fringe. However, there were areas of 16th century Europe where a greater diversity of religious thought was tolerated, mainly due to the relative decentralisation of political power and the already existing diversity of ethnic and religious communities. In particular, in the lands of the Polish-Lithuanian Union, later the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, the Polish Minor Reform Church, or Polish Brethren, broke away from the mainstream Reform Church in 1565. This church combined belief in adult baptism with a non-Trinitarian theology. In Transylvania, the 1568 Edict of Torda granted freedom of religion to local communities, which enabled the establishment of the Unitarian Church under its bishop Ferenc David, 1520-1579. Both churches were influenced by another non-Trinitarian writer, Faustus Socinus, 1539-1604, who eventually settled in Poland, although he never accepted the adult baptism practiced by the Polish Minor Church. He gave his name to Socinianism, non-Trinitarian theology, which later also spread to England and beyond. From one point of view, the English Reformation was a top-down process driven by Henry VIII's desire to have his marriage to Catherine of Aragon annulled. However, at the same time, there is evidence of growing support for Protestant ideas, including those of more radical reformers. This can be traced historically through the 16th and 17th centuries. Evangelical reformers. Under Henry VIII, many seeking a more far-reaching reformation were suppressed, including the English Bible translator William Tyndale, 1494-1536, who was burned at the stake. Puritans. Under Elizabeth I, English Protestants advocating further church reforms, including seeking to rid the church of perceived Catholic elements such as governance by bishops and the use of clerical vestments, became known as Puritans. Separatists or dissenters. Later, those who broke away from the established Church of England completely were known as separatists or dissenters. Many of these groups, including Quakers, Levellers, Diggers and Ranters, flourished at the time of the English Civil War, 1642-1651, and during the period of the Commonwealth of England, 1649-1660, when their religious ideals often combined with those of social reform. This period has been seen as a late flourishing of the Radical Reformation in England. Nonconformists. Upon the restoration of the monarchy under Charles II, 1660, the Act of Uniformity, 1662, prescribed the correct form of public prayers and worship in the Church of England. Thousands of clergy and laypeople who disagreed with the Act left or were ejected from the Church, leading to the concept of nonconformist churches. Churches classed as nonconformist included Reformed, Calvinist, Presbyterian and Congregationalist churches, other independent free churches, and Baptists. The extent to which Baptists were descended from the various Anabaptist movements which had emerged in the 16th century is debated, but the first English Baptists originated in the English separatist community in Amsterdam in the early 17th century, and congregations were soon established in London and elsewhere. Baptists and other nonconformists were granted freedom of worship under the 1689 Act of Toleration, but barred from political office and from attending the universities. It is worth noting that it was not until the 1813 Doctrine of the Trinity Act, passed 8 years after the birth of Christadelphian founder John Thomas, that Unitarians and other non-Trinitarians were legally allowed to worship in England. Once again, dissenting and nonconformist groups were seeking to put into practice the ideal of a church as a community of committed believers, rather than simply conforming to the church as an institution of state or society. The growing legal framework of toleration allowed these groups to establish themselves, yet at the same time, throughout this period, many religious dissenters and radicals sought refuge in North America, where they could enjoy greater religious freedom. These developments form the direct backdrop to the emergence of Christadelphians. The father of John Thomas was minister to various independent nonconformist congregations in England, and Thomas himself arrived in America during a period of religious revival known as the Second Great Awakening. In the next article, we'll be exploring these direct influences on the formation of the first Christadelphian communities. Some Christadelphian writers have looked to earlier groups, particularly those of the Radical Reformation, to find spiritual ancestors who shared in full the Christadelphian understanding of Bible truth. In exploring this, I feel personally quite conflicted. Through the lens of a historian, I want to simply understand these groups on their own terms, from their own writings, in the context of the time they lived in. I want to try to be as objective as possible, and certainly not to pass judgment on whether or not they had a full understanding of the gospel message as I believe it. On the other hand, as a Christian and a Christadelphian, it can be helpful to see historical parallels with my own faith and to learn from the example and perspective of those who've gone before. It can also be inspiring to see the faith and commitment of those who held their faith in very adverse circumstances, often in the face of serious opposition or persecution. Overall, I think it's fair to say from the evidence available to us, no single group in history fully shared all aspects of Christadelphian teaching. But perhaps from a historical point of view, it would be unrealistic and anachronistic to expect them to have done so. Christadelphian teachings are founded on the Bible, but are also shaped by their time and place in history. However, this article has identified some key themes within the history of Christianity, which have also evidently fed into the formation and identity of our Christadelphian community today. These include the idea of the church as a gathering of committed believers rather than a state institution, the ideal of returning to the example of teaching and practice of the apostles and the first century church, the Protestant emphasis on the authority of the Bible rather than that of any church hierarchy, key doctrines of some of the radical reformers, including the adult baptism of believers, non-violence, and a non-Trinitarian understanding of Christ and God. More intangibly, the Christadelphian community has perhaps also been shaped by an ongoing sense of calling to reform, evident throughout Christian history and expressed in the Latin phrase Ecclesia Semper Reformanda, meaning both that the church is always reforming and always in need of reform. As we'll see in the next article, this enduring impulse found particular expression in the Christadelphian movement as it emerged in the 19th century.